Welcome to the New World. Episode 4, Empty Promises. Last time, we left off on Columbus triumphant in the streets of Barcelona, having sailed to the west and back. Though the Genoese admiral still insisted to everyone that it was Asia he had discovered, everyone knew it was something else entirely. Regardless, the land had two claimants, Spain and Portugal. As I said earlier, King João had told Columbus that he was claiming these new islands, and the king was following through on his promise. Rumors spread in the Spanish court that João was sending a fleet of his own under the famous Francisco de Almeida, the future governor of Portuguese India. It was clear that something had to be done to reestablish just who had the rights to what land before a new war started. So, the Spanish and Portuguese both went to a neutral third party, the papacy. Pope Alexander VI, aka Rodrigo Borgia, was a Spaniard, and he was also greatly excited by the discoveries of Columbus and the prospect of Christianizing the peoples he had described. The Pope issued a series of papal bulls confirming the rights of Spain to colonize and Christianize these newfound territories, just as Portugal had done with its African territories, which would lay the groundwork of the Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494. The major point of this treaty was that it was establishing a firm line just to the west of the Cape Verde Islands. Everything east of the line would be Portuguese if it was not already occupied by Spain. Everything to the west was Spanish. The interesting part of this treaty is that neither side really knew what they were agreeing to here. For one, they didn't know that there were not just a group of islands, but in fact two continents to the west. For another, the line happened to give Portugal the right to the still undiscovered Brazil, which lay just over the east of the treaty border. Of course, the treaty did not apply to the other powers of Europe, some of whom were suddenly interested in building caravels of their own, helmed, of course, by Italian admirals. Long before that treaty had been signed, Fernando and Isabel had already sent Columbus on a second, much larger voyage. He now had 17 ships, 5 big and 12 small, and as many as 1,500 people. Among these were royal advisors to the king and queen, who had been appointed to have a look at this mysterious new realm for themselves. They also brought priests, laborers, women, and soldiers who had fighting experience in Granada, the first of the so-called conquistadors. The aim was to establish a proper colony this time, and mine the supposedly vast quantities of gold in Hispaniola straight away. Not only that, but Columbus promised to Christianize the natives of the islands, as he said he would. They left the Canaries on October the 13th, 1493, and made it to the Caribbean in only 20 days. They explored a few islands that made up the Lesser Antilles, including Dominica, Antigua, Guadalupe, and the Virgin Islands, kidnapping local Caribs as they went to later sell as slaves or interpreters. One of these instances at the island of San Martin ended in the death of one of Columbus's men, the very first casualty of his voyages. On November 15th, they made it to an island the natives called Borriquen, but the Spanish later called Puerto Rico. They continued further to Hispaniola, and at last reached the site of Navidad. One can imagine the surprise on Columbus's face when he made it to his camp to find nothing but ashes. He ordered guns to be fired from the ships to signal any would-be survivors hiding inland, but none came out. Venturing further, the expedition found a village on the coast that contained the anchor of the Santa Maria and some other goods from the first voyage. The locals, including the cacique Guacanagari, who first agreed to the settlement, claimed that not long after Columbus left, the men left in Navidad went hunting for gold and women. The violence that resulted from this rape and pillage led the locals to burn Navidad to the ground and kill the men inside. Some wanted revenge for the deaths of the men of Navidad, but Columbus refused, instead turning east and establishing a new settlement he called Isabella along the northern coast of the modern-day Dominican Republic. Columbus had decided on the site for a reason. There was supposedly plenty of gold up in the hills, and a river fed into the sea, which he intended to build water mills on. However, this was a bad idea. Not only was Isabella's harbor bad for accommodating his large number of ships, or really any ships at all, but the river was unsuitable for building the mills. Furthermore, Columbus and his would-be colonists had basically no idea what to do when they got there. It turns out that starting a colony thousands of miles away from home is a hard job, and many of the people who made the journey found themselves unready for the work involved. Many already wanted to go home, or run off into the forests and loot gold from the Tainos. On top of all that, the searches for the gold Columbus swore was on the island kept turning up empty, and the Tainos were growing increasingly angry at these Spaniards who wanted all their stuff. In his book 1493, author Charles C. Mann elaborates on the crisis of command that Columbus faced. He claims that Columbus now had two jobs: to search for China, which Columbus was confident was still just over the horizon, and set up a colony on this new island of Hispaniola. But he couldn't leave yet, because Isabella was just setting up and needed his attention. The colonists wanted to move on from Isabella and establish a colony in a more optimal location, but Columbus needed to start mining gold right away if he wanted to prove that all his blustering about riches was true, and he didn't know of any other place he could find it. So, rather than going on a voyage or establishing a colony elsewhere, Columbus sat in Isabella, and tensions stewed. Nevertheless, Columbus did decide to send back 12 of his ships in February to carry anyone who wanted to leave. And with word that there was still totally tons of gold here, but could you please send more farmers and laborers and people who actually want to be here for more than 5 minutes? Also, aboard was what little gold they actually could find, because as we will see, the island wasn't entirely devoid of the stuff. A month later, he personally went on an expedition inland to find another potential gold site, but literally the day he left, one of the royal advisors tried to steal two ships and take them back to Spain to tell the monarchs that in reality Columbus had no idea what he was doing, and the colonists were starving, and there was no gold, at least not enough for all the effort. However, he was stopped by Diego Columbus and was imprisoned. The admiral reached the supposed location of all the gold, but none was there. Undeterred, he had his men set up a fort to guard the site and went back to Isabella. But then there was rumors that a local Taino king was going to attack the fort that had been raised on his land. So Columbus preemptively kidnapped the king and put him on a ship to be sent to Spain as a slave. But then that ship sank and the king drowned. If the Tainos didn't hate the Spaniards already, they sure did now. Just when the last of the food the Spaniards brought with them was starting to run out, the natives cut all trade relations. They even began a low-grade war with the Spanish, running a series of skirmishes with the settlers, who were starting to raid their food storehouses. Mann claims that the Taino would grind ash and peppers into a powder that, when used in large quantities, acted as a form of tear gas that the natives would use in battle, themselves protected by cloth bandanas. All this, and there was no gold, and the colony was still barely up and running. What did Columbus do now that everything he'd spent the last several months for was in jeopardy? Well, he courageously got on a boat and sailed away. That's right. Leaving his brother Diego in charge of Isabella, Columbus said something along the lines of, "Don't worry, guys, I'm sure food will come soon from Spain. I'm gonna go exploring to the west. Sit tight, see you in a couple months." As it turns out, he wasn't wrong. But that didn't stop everyone in Isabella from rightfully hating his guts. Those 12 ships I mentioned earlier returned to Spain carrying Columbus's letter that all was well and there was gold everywhere. However, that didn't stop the crew of those ships from babbling that everything sucked in the Indies, that Columbus was exaggerating about everything, including his own skill, and that there was no gold. Not willing to give up, Isabel and Fernando sent Bartolomeo Columbus, the brother that had once been captured by pirates, to join his brothers with the much-needed food. Meanwhile, Cristoforo, having abandoned his failing colony in its time of need, was happily exploring the southern coast of Cuba and Jamaica. Believe it or not, he was still convinced that he was on the east coast of China, possibly even as far south as Indochina or Malaysia. He was so adamant about this that he made his men sign a statement under penalty of a hefty fine that they were still, in fact, in Asia. The only one who didn't sign was a guy named the Abbot of Lucerne, who was actually just along for the ride because he was a tourist. He didn't even have a job. Having exhausted the provisions for his pleasure cruise, Columbus returned to Isabella in September, where things were in dire straits. Food was running out, some Spaniards were still going out into the forest and killing or stealing from natives. Others were dying from syphilis that they caught from native women. Now, I didn't mention this before, but syphilis is not actually native to Europe. It comes from the New World, which is why the Europeans were so unprepared for it, and we see reports of this mysterious new disease starting to spread back home not long after the first voyage returned. Columbus himself fell ill with some other disease, probably gout, upon his arrival in Isabella, and all they could do was wait until Bartolomeo finally arrived in June with the food. He did so, but a few months later some deserters took off in the ships he came in on. By 1495, Columbus decided that he had to start sending something other than deserters home. Despite claiming that gold was everywhere in Hispaniola, he began a massive program of sending home slaves, hoping to sell them back in Spain as proof that he was doing something noteworthy. Hugh Thomas claims that this led to over 1,600 people being captured by the Spaniards, with 550 of them being sent to Europe. Through all of this, there were still no attempts to Christianize the population like the monarchs and the Pope had wanted. Columbus followed up this program by building fortresses in the central mountain range of the island, giving him greater control over the remaining population, who he now forcefully extracted tribute from like a feudal lord. Along the way, he had to fight a couple of battles with the natives, but the steel weapons and armor of the Spanish ensured that the admiral came out on top. Fernando and Isabel, though, were not impressed with his performance thus far. In 1495, they issued a decree that allowed any Spaniard to colonize the Indies if he wished, so long as he left from Cadiz and sent home two-thirds of any gold he found. They had to self-finance the trip and bring priests with them to make sure everyone was a good Christian, including the natives, but they could be made governor for life of any place they conquered. Columbus was no longer the only competitor. While they sent him some more supplies, Isabel and Fernando told him to get his act together, because now that big lifelong viceroyalty and governorship they gave him back in 1492 only applied to Hispaniola. Columbus realized that things were turning against him back in Europe, and the only way he could salvage the situation was to head home. He did so in 1496, leaving Bartolomeo in control of the island and making the trip on the first two ships built by Europeans in America. So ends the second voyage of Christopher Columbus. It goes without saying that this one was far less successful than the previous. Columbus had left Spain in 1493 a hero, with 1,500 people and a blank check to do whatever he wanted. Now he was coming back 3 years later as the governor of a failing colony on Hispaniola, having delivered on none of the promises he had made. No gold, no conquest, no Asia, no Christianization of the natives. All he'd sent back were slaves, deserters, and syphilis. Let me quote Columbus himself on why he definitely shouldn't be blamed for all of this. "Evil words arose in Spain with belittlement of the enterprise which had been begun, because I had not at once dispatched home ships laden with gold, not allowing for the brevity of time which had elapsed, nor everything else which I had said of the many problems. I was placed in abhorrence, and obstacles erected against whatever I said or asked. I decided, therefore, to come before your highnesses and show my incredulity at this, and also to show that I was right in everything." I don't know about you, but that sounds like a guy who can't take credit for his own failure. He way overpromised and way underdelivered, and he's basically saying here that everyone's been against him all this time, and it's not his fault he couldn't send home that much gold after being on the island supposedly overflowing with the stuff for 3 years. Obviously, he wasn't a complete failure, and starting a colony thousands of miles away from any European outpost is hard, but Columbus was working on a self-imposed tight schedule to begin with, having told everyone there was plenty of shiny stuff and it was easy to get. He also pissed off the only people that might have been able to help him by kidnapping and enslaving over 1,000 Native Americans, and it was only through military conquest that he could get them to provide for him again. While he's off dealing with that, let's give a quick summation about the one group of people who I've avoided talking about now for far, far too long. The natives, who have been living on the West Indies for centuries. As I said, they're referred to as the Tainos, They migrated to the islands of the Caribbean around 1000 AD. The word itself, Taino, means good in their language. They had been trying to tell the Spaniards that they were the good guys, at least in relation to the Carib raiders I had mentioned in the last episode. You may also see them referred to as Arawaks, which is because that is their language group that they share with some peoples along the coast of South America. They traveled around the islands in strong canoes, but maintained only a small amount of contact with others on the mainland, such as the powerful civilizations of Mesoamerica to the west. Bartolomeo Columbus, the brother of Christopher, claimed that there were over 1 million of them on Hispaniola alone when they first arrived, though there were probably only about 150,000 across all the Caribbean. They lived in big towns of over 1,000 people at a time, with each one being governed by a cacique, who could be male or female. We've already met one cacique, Guacanagari, that guy who originally gave permission for Columbus to construct Navidad, then explained to him why it was burned to the ground a year later. All the houses, which several families lived in and slept on cotton hammocks, were arranged around a plaza. Families were traced matrilineally by their mothers, rather than patrilineally by their fathers. And polygamy was generally accepted. Several caciques were more powerful than others, ruling up to 100 villages at a time. You could consider these kings and queens. Men were often naked, and women often wore cotton skirts. Caciques distinguished themselves with feather headdresses. There were no slaves, although people of the upper class had more rights than people of the lower class. Some of the people who Columbus encountered worshipped two major gods, Yucahu, the god of salt water, and Atabe, goddess of fresh water. As for the gold that Columbus sought so frequently, they found it in rivers and made plates out of it. And though they didn't know how to smelt it, they did trade with the South Americans who did. As for what they grew and ate, it was mainly cassava and sweet potatoes, but also pineapples, peanuts, beans, squash, pepper, and tobacco, which they smoked often. They were not generally warlike, which is probably why Columbus figured he could conquer them so easily, though they definitely defended themselves from Carib raiders from Guadalupe and Martinique, and later, of course, the Spanish. We see the Spaniards sometimes refer to them as evil cannibals as well, but keep in mind that the Spaniards are the ones writing this history, and they can say anything about these people they want. They seem like an interesting culture, and it's such a shame that the only way we can know anything about them is from some archaeology and the writings of the people from this time period. Not too long from now, the Taino culture will be gone. Columbus wanted to return to Hispaniola as soon as he could, but he ran into a few unfortunate delays. As you might expect, there weren't too many people willing to finance or accompany a new expedition from him if it was going to go the same way as the last one. The second obstacle was more serious. Columbus bore witness to tragedy that struck the Spanish court. Several of Fernando and Isabel's children, namely the Infante, that means Prince, Juan, in 1497, and their daughter Isabel in 1498. Not only that, but the death of Juan meant that Fernando and Isabel no longer had any male children, meaning that the royal house of Trastamara was dying out. The next king of Spain would be Philip von Habsburg, who was married to their daughter Juana. The monarchs went into mourning and seclusion for several months, further delaying Columbus. With the death of Infante Juan, Columbus also lost a part of his own prestige, as one of his sons had been working as a page for the prince. It wasn't until May of 1498 that he was finally able to leave. He wrote goodbye to his son Diego, saying, "Your father loves you as much as he loves himself." Just as a side note, that same month, the Portuguese explorer Vasco da Gama reached India, and John Cabot, who I will absolutely talk about soon, was preparing for his third and final voyage to explore North America. Europe's reach was expanding. Columbus's third voyage set off with five caravels made up of 200 men, including soldiers, sailors, priests, women, laborers, and others of various professions. He was told before he left that the monarchs now wanted him to parcel up his land amongst the people. Columbus was all about resource extraction and profit, but the name of the game now was settlement and Christianization. The West Indies were an extension of Spain, not some gold mine in a foreign land guarded by a few soldiers, which is pretty much what Columbus had been trying to do up until now. He sent three of his ships directly to Hispaniola to give the colony its much-needed supplies, while he investigated rumors that the Portuguese had been spreading of a big landmass to the south of Hispaniola. He set off from the west from Cape Verde, landing at an island he called Trinidad. Here a scene out of some comedy occurred, where the Spaniards were approached by natives in a canoe. Columbus tried to show them that he meant no harm by having one of his men play a tambourine while the others danced to the music. They also shot off their shiny swords and silverware to lure in the natives. But instead, the men in the canoe shot arrows at them. After a short exchange of arrows and crossbow fire, the natives rode away. Columbus continued south, where he found the mouth of the massive Orinoco River. This is where it became apparent that he had just come across the continents of South America. What's that, Columbus? It's definitely still Asia? Whatever. Here they landed and raised a cross on the beach. They were met by much more friendly natives, who gave them some gold, pearls, and interestingly, beer, probably made from maize. He continued along the Venezuelan coast to Margarita, where he found more of the pearls that he had been given. He turned north and headed across the open sea, landing in the newly founded town of Santo Domingo on Hispaniola. While Columbus was gone, things had gotten interesting. Just before he left, I actually forgot to mention that he finally did discover a gold field, and while he was sitting around in Europe, his brother Bartolomeo was at work mining this gold, along with founding Santo Domingo as an alternative to Isabella, which most people had abandoned by this point. However, the magistrate of Isabella, a guy named Roldan, accused Bartolomeo of intentionally moving everyone away to Santo Domingo to increase his own wealth and influence, and started a rebellion against the authority of the brothers Columbus. He and about 100 men plundered Isabella's armory and storehouse, and set out west towards modern Haiti, looking to start his own town on land that was, in his words, the pleasantest and most fertile part of the island and with the most natives, as well as the best-looking and best-natured women. On his way, Roldan told the nearby natives that they didn't have to pay tribute to Isabella anymore. Bartolomeo decided to let him go in peace, since Roldan actually now held most of the weapons on the island. But Isabella was soon in dire straits without food or native help. Rather than helping out this ghost town, the admiral's brother decided instead to build more forts to ensure that the natives paid tribute to Santo Domingo. It was now that Columbus arrived from the south, and realized things were still very fragile. He reassumed command, and sent word out across the island that anyone who wanted to go home could do so for free. 300 people took him up on this offer, but Roldan in the west remained hostile, claiming that Columbus brothers were conspiring to hand over the island to the Republic of Genoa once they'd finished sucking out all the personal profit they could. Columbus managed to talk him down after several attempts, allowing Roldan to settle wherever he wanted in exchange for submitting himself to the admiral once more. For the first time in years, things seemed to be going well for Columbus again. His naysayers were heading home or submitting to him, or muttering under their breath, and the long-sought-after gold mine was up and running. However, this peace was broken by the arrival of one Francisco de Bobadilla, who claimed that he had come with a royal order to take Columbus's position as governor and that the admiral was fired. I think I'm going to leave off on that cliffhanger. Columbus's third voyage was at an end, and though it didn't last very long, it confirmed the existence of a new continent to the south of the Caribbean Sea. Not only that, but the foundation of Santo Domingo meant that Hispaniola finally now had a stable administrative center with which to rule the rest of the island. Now that there were also the gold fields and somewhat pacified colonists, the colony finally had its chance at growth. Add to the fact that the Spanish monarchs had essentially opened the gates to anyone who wanted to travel to the West Indies, and things were getting busier. Let's not forget the Tainos, though. Throughout this episode, things have gotten progressively worse for them on Hispaniola, having been enslaved and subjugated by Columbus in massive numbers. Remember when I said that Columbus sent over 500 of them back to Europe? Well, that's certainly true, but 40% of them died on the way there. Many more died simply waiting for someone to buy them in Castilian ports, either from mistreatment, disease, or unfamiliarity with the climate. Those who survived would be paraded around as human zoo animals, or put to work in galleys or on plantations for the rest of their lives. A miserable and unjust end for a people who had only known their oppressors for a few short years. Remember also how I said that many thousands of people living on Hispaniola were there when Columbus arrived? Some estimates state that nearly a third of those people were gone by the time Columbus departed, just 7 years after landing, either killed or enslaved by the Spanish or dead from disease. These were not simpletons, the clueless, superstitious creatures who so many European historians have characterized them as, to discuss and justify the atrocities to come. They were people with hopes and dreams and fears, and now they were gone. That was only in Columbus's time. As we will see with our next episode, things will only get worse for them with his successors, as the encomienda system is about to be introduced. And that is just as much the legacy of Columbus as anything else.